Chapter 53. Kurt and Gamet dropped silently toward the bottom of the Mediterranean in what looked like suits of body armor that had been crossed with robotic monsters from a comic book. 7 feet tall and weighing nearly 300 pounds, the trench crawler was the latest of Numa's deep diving creations. Known as an ADS, or atmospheric diving suit, because it maintained a surface level pressure of 1 atmosphere within its shell. The trench crawler allowed its occupant to dive deep and spend extended time on the bottom without the need for decompression stops, or extended time in a decompression chamber upon surfacing. It had a bulbous, rounded head, adorned with external cameras and lights, long mechanical arms that bent in directions no human arm could, and legs that were bulky and articulated at the knees. Unlike other atmospheric diving suits, the trench crawler had fully robotic arms and a wider body, allowing the diver to keep his or her hands inside the shell, where they could manipulate the controls. A pair of fully rotatable thrusters were attached to the sides, while a compartment on the back contained batteries, oxygen for 8 hours, an emergency surfacing float, and a pair of small submersible drones that could be deployed and controlled remotely from within the trench crawler's shell. Sealed inside, Kurt's face was lit by the dim glow of small screens, 2 on the right and 2 on the left. They displayed the operating systems and the camera views, while the traditional curved helmet view gave an image of the outside world. Descending beside him, Gamay Trout was in the Bravo model of the trench crawler. "Now I know how a giant feels," she said over the hydrophone.
"I hope that's not a crack about my height," Paul said. He was on the surface, acting as mission control.
"Not at all," Gamay said, "although I wouldn't need 4-inch heels if I wore this on our next date."
"Nor would you need a reservation, because the waiters would flee the restaurant in horror," Kurt added, interrupting the two of them. "Time to focus. We're nearing the bottom."
"Sonar has you just south of the wreck," Paul said, "with lights on. You should see it in 30 seconds or less."
Kurt switched the exterior lights on, and the water around him lit up as tiny particles reflected it back in his direction. Kurt's left hand was on the thruster control, his right hand on a keypad. "Angling lights downward," he said as he rotated the suit's exterior lights. Above and to his right, a second set of lights appeared as Gamay switched hers on.
60 feet, Kurt said. For a moment, there was nothing to see but darkness. Then finally, a barren, grayish plain below. Watching the depth control meter on one of the screens, Kurt saw the absolute depth as 9,758 feet. A second number underneath it read only 50 and was slowly clicking down toward 0.
50 feet, Kurt said. "Switch to neutral."
"Neutral buoyancy," Gamay said.
Kurt adjusted the ballast in his suit and his descent slowed and then stopped. Spread out on the plain were metal parts, junk and debris, but nothing more.
"Anyone see a submarine around here?"
"You've drifted a little farther south," Paul told them. "Head north. It's no more than 500 feet from your present position."
Engaging the thrusters, Kurt and Gamay moved north, traveling in a slow formation. The debris field thinned, and then the curved hull of a submarine's central section came into view. Closer in, it was easy to see how the scaffolding around it had broken. Kurt said,
"Where to, Paul?" "You'll need to maneuver around the far edge for a safe entry. Too much damage to this side."
They'd planned the dive in advance, but to allow Kurt and Gamay to concentrate on their tasks, it had been decided that Paul would act as overall director. Kurt and Gamay activated their thrusters again and moved past the near end of the hull. Impact damage, piping, wires, and other encrusted debris made entry there impossible. On the far side, they got a better view of the entire section. It was covered with marine snow and dripping with rust, but in better shape than many wrecks Kurt had seen. Spread out in front of it was another debris field of equipment, machinery, and assorted junk.
"Either everything fell out when they raised and dropped her," Gamay said, "or they just ripped everything out when they were looking for the cultures."
"Probably a little of both," Kurt said.
He slowed and held his position, studying the submarine. Looking at it was like studying the cross-section of a model. The circular curve of the pressure hull was obvious, even with the impact damage.
The decks crossed at an angle because the hull did not sit perfectly flat on the bottom, but each deck was wide open to the sea. "Looks like they cut the hull at the limits of the crew quarters and mess hall," Kurt said, gazing into the opening. "Obviously, they wanted to leave the heavy engine room at the stern and the dangerous forward torpedo room on the bottom. Have to give them some credit for thinking ahead." "Should we go in?" Gamay asked. Even though the hull was wide open, it was still no place for 7-foot-tall, man-shaped machines. "No," Kurt said. "Release the drones." As he gave the order, Kurt pressed 2 red buttons, releasing drones Alpha and Bravo. A subtle vibration ran through the suit as the drones deployed. "I'm releasing Charlie," Gamay replied. The football-shaped drones would have a far easier time searching through the wreck. They could fit through gaps and hatches. They were smooth-sided, with nothing extending outside their shells that could snag on debris or cables. They could move and see in all directions. "I have Alpha," Kurt said. "Paul, I'm releasing Bravo to your steady hand." "Roger that," Paul said. "Telemetry is active. I have control of Bravo." The drones entered the hull on a different deck, their lights illuminating the vacant spaces while their motors stirred up small amounts of sediment. Gazing at the computer screen inside his helmet, Kurt watched the video from his drone as it navigated the wreck. The inspection was done at a painstakingly slow speed, compartment by compartment, foot by foot. The process would take hours. They didn't know exactly what they were looking for, but anything out of the ordinary, anything that could hold a dangerous bacterial culture and keep it secured against the sea for 50 years despite the pressure, depth, and cold. "Drone Bravo is searching the medical bay," Paul announced. "Charlie entering the mess hall," Gamay said moments later. In some ways, the work Tessa's people had done made the search easier. "Looks like they used blowtorches to remove the hatches and watertight doors," Kurt said. "I've encountered nothing to slow our progress." "There are several gaping holes in the upper deck," Gamay replied. "They cut a hole in the side of the hull on deck too as well," Paul added. "Looks like they've looted the entire medical bay. There's nothing left in here." "They've done the same thing to the mess hall," Gamay replied. "No fryer, no refrigerators, no containers. They've left nothing behind." Kurt was discovering the same thing. Not a footlocker remained in the crew quarters. Nothing that might be used to hide a sealed container. "Finish the sweep and then search the aft section with the engine room," he said. "I'm recalling my drone and switching to the forward section of the submarine." "That wasn't part of the plan," Paul reminded him. "I'm calling an audible," Kurt said. "They've picked this segment clean. If the counteragent was here, they'd have found it." "There are 12 unexploded torpedoes in there," Paul reminded him. "Don't worry," Kurt said. "I left my sledgehammer on the Griffin with you." Using his thrusters, Kurt maneuvered toward the forward section of the wreck and then guided his drone in through a small gap. This section didn't seem to have been ransacked. That gave Kurt some hope that they might find what they were looking for. "Central hull cleared," Gamay said, heading for the engine room. "I'm right behind you," Paul said. Kurt heard the chatter, but focused on his own task. The forward compartments were a jumble, skewed to the side and half-filled with sediment. The torpedoes had come off their racks and lay about like fallen logs in a dark forest. That none of them had exploded upon impact was a testament to the design of their safeties. Still, Kurt avoided even bumping them. He didn't want to find out if those safeties were still working after 50 years. Maneuvering past the last of the torpedoes, he found an area of smoothly deposited silt. As the drone's thrusters began to disturb it, the outline of a boot became visible. No foot, no bone, just a boot. Kurt knew from studying previous wrecks that marine life consumed almost everything organic within a few decades of a sinking. Still, the presence of the boot reminded him that this was a grave. He continued the quest soberly until he'd examined the entire forward section and come up against the damaged forward bulkhead. There was nothing beyond that except the sand and the sea. He glanced at the chronometer. They'd been on the bottom nearly 4 hours. With the hour it had taken them to descend and the time required to surface, they were nearing a full day. Nothing in the forward section, he called out over the radio. Any luck in the engine room or aft quarters?
We're finishing up now, Gemme said. Nothing to report.
Time to head up, he said. Otherwise, Rudy will be screaming about the overtime. Recall your drone and get ready to surface.
As Paul and Gemme confirmed the order, Kurt maneuvered the drone back to where he'd found the boot. He allowed it to descend until it was almost touching the sand. As the sediment swirled, other parts of a uniform were exposed. This was someone's last resting place. Opening a compartment in the nose, he extended a tiny arm from the drone. The arm held a small round stone that Kurt released, allowing it to fall onto the silt beside the uniform. A small gesture of respect. That done, Kurt retracted the arm. He was about to bring the drone out of the hull when he noticed a small metallic object sitting upright in the silt. It was a brass pin, a decoration given to sailors for completing a special type of mission. As Kurt focused on the pin, he realized he'd seen that type of pin before, not on an Israeli sailor, but on the uniform of a friend who was a longtime French submariner. Without pause, Kurt plucked the decoration off the sediment and stowed it away. He then retrieved the drones and joined Gemme for the nearly hour-long trip to the surface. All the way up, he mulled over a single question. What was a French naval insignia doing in the wreck of an Israeli submarine that was supposedly sent to the bottom by the French Air Force?